This is Science Friday. I'm Myra Flato. For many of us, our first pandemic has been this COVID-19 one. But the U.S. has a long history of public health crises. AIDS, measles, the flu, they're all illnesses that left lasting impacts on the country. You would think, then, that the country would be better prepared to deal with public health crises since they happen not infrequently. Well, you would be wrong. A new article in The Atlantic explores the country's gaps in public health preparedness and why many experts saw the country's mishandling of the pandemic coming a mile away. The article is called "We're Already Barreling Toward the Next Pandemic." It was written by my guest, Ed Young, science reporter for The Atlantic, based in Washington. Ed won a Pulitzer Prize last year for his coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic. Also joining me is Dr. Greg Gonsalves, global health activist and epidemiologist at Yale in New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Ed, let me give you the first question here. A lot of people are going to be wondering why we're already talking about the next pandemic when this one isn't even over yet. Why did you decide to write about this now?
Well, I sympathize with those people. I'm sure we all want to just never have to think about this again, and I certainly don't. But I think that history tells us that if we take that attitude, we are doomed to making the same mistakes. For a very long time now, the US and the world at large has been trapped in the cycle of panic and neglect, where a new epidemic hits, everyone pays attention, investments flow in, the right moves are made to make us a little better prepared the next time, but those moves eventually get eroded. People forget, complacency settles in, and we enter these Sisyphean cycles where we never get any better at dealing with the next crisis. And the next crisis is surely upon us. More epidemics are imminent, and there's no guarantee that we'll have the luxury of facing just one at a time. So sadly, we have to walk and chew gum at the same time. We have to control this current pandemic while also trying to prepare ourselves for whatever is to come next.
Can you give me an example of what you're calling a Sisyphean cycle of panic and neglect?
Sure. So if you look at just the recent history of the last decade or so, after the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, people paid huge attention to this idea of emerging diseases that could threaten us. A lot of investments were made. That money eventually was eroded. When Zika emerged and started causing problems, a lot of money that was devoted to Ebola was cannibalized for dealing with Zika. And, you know, we don't even have to think about past epidemics. We can look at what's happened just this year. After the surge of the previous winter started abating, and when cases started falling in the spring, America and many other parts of the world dropped their guard. Testing scaled back. The CDC announced that indoor masking was no longer necessary for vaccinated people, in many ways pitting two of our most effective defenses against each other. And President Biden, on several occasions, gave what were pretty close to victory speeches. And then the Delta variant came out of other parts of the world and completely pummeled us. You know, we didn't even get out of this current pandemic before we entered into the neglect stage. And I think that, again, is why we need to start thinking about preparedness now. This cycle of panic and neglect spins so quickly that we are already heading towards the neglect phase, you know, even in the midst of this generation-defining disaster.
Greg, as an epidemiologist living through a global pandemic, when did you start thinking about the next public health crisis?
So, Ira, I've been living with another pandemic for 30 to 40 years, which is the AIDS epidemic. So I was always waiting for the shoe to drop with this one, and it finally arrived in 2020. And so it was clear early on, as you watched the United States try to respond in its disheveled, chaotic, incompetent way last year, that we were singularly unprepared for what was happening and that the next pandemic was not going to treat us as kindly as even this one has, even with its sort of devastation that it's caused so far. We're weaker than we've ever been.
So you're saying basically the COVID pandemic and how it was treated is a sort of a reflection on the total health, if I could put it that way, of the American healthcare system.
Well, the healthcare system writ large, which includes public health, which is sort of the appendix of the body of American healthcare. We spend pennies, 3 cents on every dollar on public health in the United States. So yes, and Ed talks about this in his piece at length. And, you know, if you look at the history of science and medicine, people like Elizabeth Fee, the late historian of science and medicine, you know, she discusses this at length. This is a century in the making. There's a book on Katrina that came out a few years ago. It's called Katrina, a History, 1915 to 2015. The idea here is that the catastrophe of Hurricane Katrina was avoidable as well, but the policy decisions that were made over the course of a century in that city that led to the devastation and the lack of preparedness for that natural disaster. And the same thing has happened here. We're seeing millions of infections in the US by public policy, by choices we made last year and into the years before that.
You know, this pandemic began during the Trump presidency, and a lot of people put the blame on that administration's flawed handling of it for how bad things went in the early days. But you say things would have still have been bad even without Trump. Is that your reflection again on the whole state of healthcare?
Trump made things inarguably worse, right? It was just a fiasco of incompetence, malfeasance, and I think a little bit of malign intent. And so, yes, last year could have been better, but I think we should temper our expectations about what we could have achieved last year, even with President Biden at the helm of the country. You know, the point is you get what you pay for. And we have a crumbling public health infrastructure. You know, look at the maps of COVID-19 right now, or 3 weeks ago, and then superimpose it with diabetes, maternal health, infant mortality, life expectancy, and you start seeing maps that look eerily familiar, right? The catastrophe of COVID-19 in our towns and cities across the U.S. Was recapitulated in a smaller form by chronic infectious diseases going back generations.
Ed, looking forward, what types of mechanisms do you think we need to put in place to make sure the U.S. is better equipped to deal with public health crises?
So I think there's a couple of things. Greg and others have spoken about the need for the high sustained level of public health funding that crucially cannot be eroded for other purposes. Like, that pot of money needs to be immune to the vagaries of electoral cycles and, you know, whatever Congress decides to do in each round of appropriation. Public health departments need to be able to rely on a stable and substantial amount of funding if they are to actually rebuild. There's so much to do in terms of basic infrastructure, in terms of data, in terms of hiring people. There's no use giving a department emergency funds to hire someone who might then lose their job in 2 years. And I would also argue that aside from that, aside from shoring up the public health departments, I think the US really needs to think about shoring up all of society, and especially its most vulnerable sectors. The country has shredded its social safety net for many decades now, from the Reagan administration to the ones that came after. The country is therefore weak. Those weaknesses affect everything from maternal and infant mortality to the opioid crisis, and they've manifested over the course of the COVID pandemic. And those weaknesses are fundamental. It means that many people are living on the edge. They struggle to provide enough food for their families. They struggle to earn a living wage. And when you have a novel virus that hits such a society, you get very predictable inequities and very predictable losses of health and lives. It's completely predictable that a lot of essential workers couldn't take actions to protect themselves, couldn't isolate or take the time off to get vaccines or tests, because they work low income, hourly wage jobs without any paid sick leave. We have a system where millions and millions of people have no access to healthcare, have no access to a trusted primary health provider, have no access to trusted sources of health information. So it's no wonder that even if you release incredibly efficient vaccines into that population that you'll get uptake plateauing very quickly. I mean, the US was 38th in the world in terms of vaccination rates, which is ridiculous given how much of a central role the country played in the development of those vaccines. But you know, vaccines are great, but vaccinations are what matters. And you don't get vaccinations if you have a society that is so vulnerable and so unequal.
Do you have confidence, though, that the U.S. government will be better prepared from now on to deal with the next pandemic?
In part, Eric Lander, who's the president's science advisor, has created a whole sort of new pandemic preparedness plan. But again, it's really focused on big science and the shiny toys. And there's not very much mention of the sort of basic public health, which Ed talks about in his article in The Atlantic, that we've been talking about here. We need a massive investment in public health in the United States. You don't build a castle on a weak foundation. And so the big science, the big technology approach to protecting us against our next pandemic is all well and good. But if we don't have a local infrastructure from small cities and towns in the US to big metropolises, we're in trouble, right? We fight diseases community by community, block by block. And we can see that when you look at zip code maps or census tract maps of how COVID is wreak havoc in our communities. And so I don't think President Biden, and to be fair, presidents before him, really understand the fundamental problems in American public health, and is what has been sort of a catastrophic failure to invest in public health. Because it's, you know, remember, when public health succeeds, you don't see it.
When you say invest in public health, are you talking about first responders having enough hospitals ready? I mean, you know, like gearing up for a war where you keep stuff stockpiled until you need it?
Look, let's think about maternal mortality in Georgia, the state of Georgia. Terrible, right? Is that about the wonderful obstetric care you might get at any of Emory's hospitals? No. It's about what we've done in communities around Georgia to ensure that women are healthy before pregnancy, during pregnancy, and after pregnancy. So we need to build up frontline public health, right? To make people less vulnerable, communities less vulnerable. Yeah, yes, we should have more first responders. We should have better sort of protocols in hospitals. We should figure out how to deal with the sort of shortages of key commodities. But keep going backwards to the very place where health happens, in homes, in communities, on blocks, and realize that a lot of risk happens there.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. And to mitigate that risk, we should be doing what?
But look, since 2008, we lost 50 to 60,000 frontline public healthcare workers. They never came back, you know, and the public health associations around the country suggest the deficit in frontline public healthcare workers is in the hundreds of thousands, right? Again, we spend 3 cents on every dollar on public health in comparison to healthcare. I talk to health departments around the country, you know, they're doing vaccines now. They can't do testing in vaccines. So this week it's vaccines. Right? The understaffing is incredible. Also, the physical infrastructure of some of these public health departments, the data systems of some of these public health departments. You know, we do not have a robust, strong 21st century public health infrastructure in the US, from physical infrastructure, data infrastructure, and human resources.
And you're saying this is not by accident?
It's not by accident. You know, we make choices about what we think is important in our society. And you know, as Ed said in his article, when quoting Elizabeth Fee, public health always gets the short end of the stick when it comes to making public policy decisions.
Greg touched on this earlier. About last month, the Biden administration released a $65 billion pandemic preparedness plan. Is this plan going to address the deficiencies that you talk about, Ed?
I don't think it is, for two reasons. You know, $65 billion sounds like a lot, but it's actually much less than what others have suggested is necessary to truly bolster the country against pandemics. And at least two-thirds of that pot goes towards things like vaccines, therapeutics, diagnostics, the kind of biomedical countermeasures that we think of as being crucial to pandemic preparedness. Now, I'm not saying that we don't need vaccines. Obviously, those are great. They're good to have. They're important. But if you devote two-thirds of a preparedness plan to them now, like after everything we've learned over the last 2 years, that suggests to me that we've not actually learned the right lessons. You know, like I said, we developed vaccines at incredible pace, and we now are 38th in the world in vaccination rates. The deaths per capita from COVID are higher in the US after the point when all adults became eligible for vaccines than in 100 plus other countries before vaccines were available. That's a shocking statistic that should make us think hard about what actually it means to be ready or to be strong against an infectious disease. I do think that if people are looking at the last 2 years and thinking, well, what we really need is just to do the same thing, but harder, you know, to get a vaccine, but faster. I just think that's the wrong lesson. Like, if anything, it might be counterproductive. Like, a lot of vaccine hesitancy stems from this idea that the vaccine development process was rushed, that corners were cut, and that, you know, adequate safety tests weren't done. I don't think that rationale is correct, but it does exist, and it does explain why a lot of people have been reluctant to get vaccinations. Now, you know, you look at that situation and you think, well, we'll just make vaccines quicker. I just don't think that's the right strategy. We need to start coming to grips with actually how vulnerable and weak a lot of sectors of American society were, and how those weaknesses cannot simply be addressed by throwing more biomedical countermeasures more quickly at the problem. You need to sort of fix the weak foundations rather than just layering more technological plaster on top of them.
We have run out of time, gentlemen. So much to talk about, such interesting stuff you have to say. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Ed Yong, science reporter for The Atlantic, based in Washington. Ed won a Pulitzer Prize last year for his coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic. And Dr. Greg Gonsalves, global health activist and epidemiologist at Yale, based in New Haven, Connecticut. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Ara.
Thanks for having me.